Hi everyone, welcome to PA Talks, a podcast series by Parametric Architecture, where we are joined by esteemed figures from the world of design and architecture to get into their personal stories, the obstacles they've overcome, their creative process, and their insights into the future. It's great to have you with us. Enjoy our engaging discussions, and to support our podcast, please find out more information in the links provided in the description below. In this episode, we have Winka Dubbeldum in our studio. She's the co-founder of Architectonix, a widely recognized practice for its award-winning projects and for their use of smart building systems and innovative structures. Winka is the chair of Weitzman Architecture at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of Strange Objects, New Solid and Massive Things, book that was published in 2021. She also serves as the external examiner for the Bartlett UCLA in London and is one of the creative directors of CityX exhibit in the virtual Italian pavilion at the Venice Architecture Biennale. Before we dive into the episode, let's highlight Pecademy, an architectural educational platform dedicated to parametric design and computational tools in architecture. In collaboration with top architects and designers, we have covered a vast array of topics in this domain. Join our live workshops and explore the cutting-edge intersection of design, technology, and architecture. Now let's get into the conversation. Okay, thank you so much, Winka, for joining our office for this show, PA Talks. You know, we have hosted more than 50 amazing guests in our PA Talks episodes, and it's really great to have you in the show. We've been following your work for so many years, and the last time we met actually was around 2019 probably in Istanbul again, and in that time we were just starting the shows and the episodes. But this time you're here in our own office, so excited to have you here. Thank you. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, no, so great to be here. Thank you for inviting me, and congrats on your new office. It's always great to be back in Istanbul.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. So you were flying to Istanbul from London, a couple of projects there probably, and then in Istanbul you're going to visit some sites in Cappadocia, is that right? Am I right?
Yeah, we have a project under construction in London, and it's a good time to do some site visits. We just poured foundations, so it's always a good moment to see whether the levels are right and are they doing a good job. So we spend the whole day essentially doing site visits, having meetings with engineers, and excited to also see that. And always good when you fly to stop over and do whatever you need to do. But being back in Istanbul is amazing.
Yeah, thank you so much. So I'm sure all of our audience know you and you don't need any introduction. But in short, would you like to introduce yourself as like, who is Winka and what are you focused on these days? And what is your practice focused on?
Yeah, sure. I'm originally from Holland, so I'm Dutch. Came to the US in 1990 to study at Columbia University. Worked for Bernard Schumi, Stephen Hall, and Peter Eisman. But I had to think about where I worked. It's a long time ago. Shortly after, in 94, I started my own office, started teaching Columbia. And after that, also at the University of Pennsylvania. And did that for 8 years, so one semester Penn, one semester Columbia. And the office has always been this mix of academics, research, and design. Mm-hmm. And to fast forward, I became chair at Penn in 2013 and realized that although we were already 20 years in the digital design realm, that people were still saying the word new when they mentioned it. And so one of the first things I did as chair was to have a conference on the new normal that we used to kind of investigate. If you state that digital is now the normal, where do we innovate from there? What is this new platform? What are the new offices as we see them happening? There were a lot of hybrid offices, robotics and design and research, and all kinds of other versions. So it was a super interesting conference because I think It might have been the first one that stated that digital design was there to stay and was not going to disappear ever again. Mm-hmm. But also to see if it is there, what is then, what are the areas we can still investigate in and where should we innovate?
Mm-hmm. So around 90s, this hype about digital was emerging and most companies, offices, architects were so excited about the new paradigm, paradigm shift, let's say. And architectonics just emerged out of these paradigm shifts and became a practice. How do you think this paradigm shift that we were expecting in that moment about mm-hmm. digital to solve the challenges of architectural process have emerged in the last 20 years? And were we expecting this in that era? And on what stage we are successful of using digital tools?
Yeah, it's a super interesting question because I actually graduated in 1990 in Holland already with computer drawings. I think it was the first one maybe. And you could say the digital was there in the 90s, but it was very much based on two-dimensional CAD drawings. It wasn't really CAD called then, it was called Vectorworks or ArchiCAD in Europe, I think. And we were working on that as well, but I wasn't that interested in that. So for the longest time, I would design in 3D software, but then cut sections and draw the construction drawings by hand, which was the complete opposite of most offices where people would draw sketches by hand and then make two-dimensional CAD drawings.
But that was a shift. That was a shift.
Total shift, yeah.
Your approach was a total shift, yeah.
Yeah, and it was definitely a very, very small group of people doing that. It was hard to find 3D software at that point. When I worked for Eisenman, I was sent on a workshop to Ohio to the inventor of Form Z, which is so ancient now if I think about it, but it was super exciting that we were three design architects of Eisenman's office were sent there. And it's funny to think about this now, but that was like a real thing. And I remember one of the first projects in the office was a folded glass building we did in Soho in Manhattan. And the real benefit I realized was that we actually never sent two-dimensional drawings to the people that made the folded glass and the mullions, and because everything was in angles. But we sent 3D drawings with XYZ coordinates. And you could say that in 1998, I think, was probably the first parametric. Design that we didn't call parametric because the term didn't exist yet, but it was really coordination through 3D dimensional drawings that essentially made it possible to create a very complex manufactured artifact, our facade, to absolute perfection. So although things came from China, Spain, and were put together in Brooklyn, it was amazing that when it arrived in Soho, it all fit.
Yeah, yeah. And in the office, you almost work on all the scales, from even product design into installations, and also with the recent projects, a much more larger scale of master plans and on city scale. How do you think this is how do you keep the balance of the same kind of design typology or the same kind of design language and different scales? Every project has its own challenges. Yeah. That's totally understandable. But every architect is also have a design process, has a kind of a methodology in solving problems. And how does this work for you?
Yeah, it's interesting because I gave a talk at SIARC the other day, and Tom Main asked exactly that question.
Really?
And that's why I was smiling when you said it. We actually use the smaller ones to innovate aspects we want to research, which then we put into the bigger one. So for example, we did...
Is it kind of prototyping or...?
Well, the prototyping we do on both scales. But it really is testing out manufacturing of 3D curved surfaces or how to clad things in ways that optimize the way you use shapes in order to not make it extravagantly expensive. You know, we are also an office that we don't really think that good design should be expensive. So we do a huge effort to optimize the amount of different curvatures or components in order to figure out ways to make things smarter, not just more beautiful, which we also like. For example, when we did the InScape meditation pods, which were gigantic 45-seater rooms, we innovated a lot in that aspect, not only how to get the climate perfect and the sound perfect and distribute everything evenly, which was actually kind of funny because these look super simple, but are one of the most highly engineered things we've made, which is interesting because you see nothing. But we used that research a lot when we started working on a 35,000 square meter hybrid building for sports and concerts in China. And it was interesting because for us, that is actually, the complexity in a weird way is not that different when you go up in scale. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the benefit of a bigger project is that you just have more money for the research. But the smaller ones, it's easier to do the research. So we use a lot of the smaller projects really to advance the bigger ones in research and knowledge and material use and material ecologies, and to see how we can make things, optimize them. And we always work at the Atypical, we're very non-standard office in many ways, but one of them is that we often work with manufacturers before we work with contractors.
Contractors, yeah. So somehow this small scale is feeding the large scale.
Yeah.
And you mentioned about the project in China, the Asian Games. It's a huge master plan, which includes landscape architects, engineers, and also different types of stadiums. And one of them includes a roof of a shell of doubly curved surface. The other one is a stadium, table tennis stadium, glass facade. Can you talk a little bit about these projects and the kind of innovations and the innovative ideas that you brought to these stadiums or the entire project, actually?
You know, I think we as an office made a big shift in that competition because it was an invited competition for 5 offices. A huge challenge to try and win that. And there were international, gigantic offices. So we were like, we kind of have to be fast and furious here. So I proposed to my business partner to make equal partners with the landscape architect, Melk. They're also Dutch, but in our same building in New York, and Toronto and Tomasetti engineers. And what that was, the idea was really to make a team that was one team and to also get their input earlier and to make them more equal and equally important. And so for us, that was a huge step, financially, but also just because the way you work is very differently. Rather than you making a design and when it's done, giving it to the engineers, from the beginning, we had that really clever, smart engineering input. And because we're all working on 3D software, it went really fast. And it was the same with the landscape architects. So very important, I think, was actually something we discovered in the process. That digital design has really erased the boundaries between engineers, consultants, and architects, and that you can work simultaneously.
Yeah, so that gap is almost closed these days between engineers and architects.
Not always, but in the right scenario, it is. Yeah, absolutely. And so we were able to develop, I said to George and Tomasetti, with the table tennis stadium that is a hybrid to be a concert hall later, I wanted a roof that basically was self-supporting, sitting on the inner bowl and cantilevering out over the outer bowl and carrying the facades. A reason being, I didn't want columns in the building. In order to have that flexibility to go from stadium to concert hall, we needed to make a design that was in seating already hybrid, but also in movement through the building. We wanted already like areas for drinks and whatever later for the coffee, for the concert hall. So they developed something called the suspendome, which is beautiful. It's very deep in the middle and then becomes very thin to the edges. And then the facade, as it had no columns, I made a steel double curved diagrid. That again, I didn't want double curved glass on because one, I wanted the facades to be really textured. The other part of the building has brass shingles that also have an overlap and have sort of a 3D feeling.
But all these glass textures are unique panels, is that right?
They are, but because we, in parametric design, figured out, it's a Rhino plugin, as you know,
yes.
You can figure out to minimize that.
Yeah.
So actually, they are the glass.
Kind of.
The glass surfaces are the same. What is actually differing, because we made planar glass and we negotiated back to the double curved diagrid with, I call them eyelids. They're aluminum triangulated fins that negotiate from the glass to the curves, and those differ. But that's very easy to make. So it was kind of a fun play between.
Yeah.
How do you, and the building is so large that it sounds like, oh, you go from planar to curved and this is a massive deal. It's actually not. Actually, if you see the building, you just see a slight texture in the glass, but you have to really zoom in to see the eyelids. And it's quite funny because it's much more subtle than even I thought when I was designing that.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. As you moved from, as like we discussed about the large scale, about the city planning, about what do you think is the impact of architect in the city planning,
yeah.
or let's say in the city scale? Because it seems out to be, there are so multidisciplinary things going on around in the city. And architects is just one part of that whole ecosystem that forms the city. It seems that architect has a huge role in this, but at the end, seems like architect has very less power on the formation of the city policies or the expansion of city. Like, it's out of control, getting out of control of the architects. Like, how do you think is the role of architect in the city these days, or in the future cities might be better?
Yeah, well, I have a sort of double agenda as a chair at University of Pennsylvania. When I run the department, it's really to bring research back to architecture. And when we did the, oh yeah, so I forgot to tell you, the master plan is 47 hectares or 116 acres. It's massive. It's 1.6 kilometers long.
Asia project.
Yeah, the Asia project. And fun fact is that the government wanted it to be 85% park, but wanted seven buildings, which is funny. So what it really is great right now, if you look at the park that is designed to be an eco park, so for the city, a green lawn. It absorbs stormwater, it filters the water. We have rebuilt the wetlands that were completely gone. So a lot of the role for this park, for the city, is apart from recreation and kindergartens and sports fields, is really to be a green lawn and filter climate and temper environmental impacts and make it better if possible. It absorbs, because it has mostly green roofs, because all these buildings have to be underground, it absorbs, I think, something like 150 kilograms of carbon a year and produces about 120 kilograms of oxygen a year. So it makes a massive difference in this environment. Yeah. And then the buildings, so what you see is the two stadiums. The one was the hybrid one we discussed. The other one is a field hockey stadium. It's kind of a topological feature in the park. It's set in the landscape. And we had something called a zero earth policy or strategy, which means that if we excavate for the wetlands and there is a valley, a shopping valley that connects under the road and under the river, the two halves of the park, we put that earth back on these buildings that had to be unseen. Yes, yes. So we have 20 meter hills in the site, which is great because the buildings are really tucked in. The sound gets absorbed by these hills. So it's very quiet inside. And what you said about architects having agency. So the funny thing, as an architect, you have agency when you do research. So the research with a zero earth strategy, sponge city, stormwater control, you have impact on climate, environment. We made multiple access roads into the park. So the park is really accessible from the neighborhood. So that way you have agency. We added a lot of functions for the people that are currently camping in the park, which already upset one of my people in the office who was like, they're actually camping on my stage. And there's an outdoor auditorium that they were camping on the stage. But it's great because the idea was really that these buildings become attractors and generators of new possibilities for the city. And according to the committee, we won because we actually made that underground valley that really dips under the road and the river, where we had to make an aqueduct for the river, which is very Dutch. But also when we
you
came...
You had to have some Dutch touch.
I had to have a Dutch touch. And it was funny, the first meeting when we met them, they're like, yeah, we have discovered a huge problem. Under the road, there is a 3 or 5 meter, I forget, but diameter main drain for the city. And it's in the way of the valley. And so we were like, oh, no problem. And we're drawing a very deep dip.
And we're going to solve this.
We're going to solve this. And we were like trying to make it look pretty that it was this gigantic thing. And then the next time we came to site, they were like, listen, we have good news, bad news. You know, when we yawned first, I was like, tell me the good news. And like, we got rid of the pipe. I was like, oh, my God. That is amazing.
What's the bad?
Yeah, the bad was actually irrelevant. We solved that. Okay. But yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. But it was a fun. But yeah, so as an architect, in that sense, if you do enough research and you really know how to innovate, reduce costs, make your designs how you want them to be, this level complexity, whatever, but also really understand that then you have to do the research and the investigations and the invention sometimes to make it affordable.
Yeah. One more thing about the city and the impact that a building has inside into a city, not in terms of environmental impact, but also socially, economically, also about the space, the feelings that it could give to the residents or to the users, to the visitors. On what stage do you think? Because the one small building is in this entire ecosystem of a city is just a small part. And on what stage do you think a building is impacting a large city or even a city, and city is impacting the building? Because sometimes you see an iconic building standing there just absorbing so much attention. People want to just go there and sit around the city, around the building, even if they want to, they're not allowed sometimes to go in. I have a huge comment on that. Most of these super architectural, beautiful buildings you see all over the world, you're not allowed to go in. Like I was in Milan, the City Life building of Zaha Hadid. I went to visit. I had my press card, but I was not able to get in. I just went to the shopping area. I was in India in Mumbai. I wanted to visit Nehru Center, which is a very good building. They just allowed me to visit the first floor, not the entire building. So this is a huge problem as well. Other than that, on what scale do you think a building is impacting the city? A city is also impacting the
Yeah. I really love what you're saying because it's so true. We are working on a tower in Rotterdam. And one of the first things we did is we kind of fractured it or tapered the tower to not throw too much light on the environment. It's a 200 meter tower. But we also made crystalline sky lobbies that function as green lungs for the tower, but also function as kind of this pulling the city up into the sky. Yes. So one is a small library, one is a gym, one is kind of like this meeting rooms that the building rents and other people can use. It kind of connects to the lower lobby, that is, of course, the entrance lobby. And my thought was exactly that, is how can you make these buildings urban? How can you make part of the city and give them also another function? That tower is really interesting because it's one of the first buildings that uses something that's very old principle, but it's a solar chimney, which means you pull the cold air from the in the night up, and then by day it pushes the hot air out. And that is connected to these lobbies. So these lobbies also have a lot of green plants to do the same as plants do. But it's interesting that that's kind of completely under-investigated. I don't know. The aspect of a building having identity, I think, is important, but not always only by making these gigantic, iconic monuments. Our first little building, what I realized is all the technological innovations of the folded glass, which then led to passive solar energy. The folding is really fun for the people in the building because you actually have rain on your facade. You see the sky, which is in the city hardly ever the case. It's also what I live there, and what was new to me, I've never seen before, is that first of all, the people who moved in were amazing. They were all completely creative. Cindy Sherman lives there. She was dating David Byrne, so I had a starstruck moment in the elevator.
Oh, this is the building with the wooden panels?
No, it's all folded glass. It's across from the street from the one you're thinking of. Okay. Yeah. It's all folded glass, and what I realized, our inhabitants were talking about the building as having identity. It was their building. So if they would go, where do you live? Oh, I live in this building that has this facade, and everyone makes that movement. And so I realized if you do these technological innovations, one, you do them because you want a more interesting, more beautiful building. Two, you want them to work better climate-wise, energy efficiency-wise. They also become characters, and it has something beautiful, but it doesn't have to be a massive icon. It can just be a building that, like this one, sits perfectly normally in a block, but has this tiny aspect that what we call in the office a 15% deviation. I like to make buildings that are 85% standard and have only 15% deviation. For the reason that I do want to make affordable buildings where everyone can live. I'm not interested in high society buildings. I like to make buildings that are affordable and good.
Yeah, you should move towards 3D printing concretes.
Well, we're looking at that already, yeah.
Yeah, I'm so much into this 3D printing concrete housing projects. I also love the affordable housing projects. But in a sense, that it could be making a good architecture as well, not just, so many projects out there without.
Well, don't get me wrong, that folded glass building is super expensive, sadly.
Yeah.
That's just the market in New York.
talking about, yes, this glass folds back, goes up. Yeah, I know. In New York, normally everything is expensive.
You can build it affordable, but then the market drives the price.
So you're practicing on many projects. You have your own office in New York, and also you're in the academia. You're at UPenn, being a dean and an educational part. How do you make your time or balance between the academia and practice and which one you are mostly focused on?
Well, it's interesting, you know, it sounds impossible, but I think I do more or less everything at the same time, all the time. And I found that it's the best way, so I'm always reachable. It sounds a little obsessive when I say it like that, but first of all, I'm not a micromanager, which helps. You know, I train them, I give them responsibilities. My teams are amazing. So I trust the process, and I'm a very long-term thinker. So when I started at Penn, I thought it's really important that we share our knowledge, be open source. So we make a huge book every year. We have a huge conference every year. We have a lot of lectures. And we share knowledge. We talk to our peers. And I think that's very important, that knowledge is shared. And I didn't feel that we at Penn were doing a great job of that. That really had a lot of other effects that I was hoping for that worked. Is one, we grew. And why it's important to grow is not because we wanted more students, but if you get a high quality group of students in and you have more of them, you can also hire better and more professors. So I more than doubled at this point the standing faculty. I balanced it gender and race wise, which I thought was overdue. So we have now actually more women on the faculty, on the standing faculty than men. But also to put women in top positions, not just, oh, let's hire a token race-specific or gender-specific person, but really get the best people that are then also the people who are balancing that. Because ultimately, it's a better education. It's for our students better that are also balanced and also very all over, especially race. We have almost every possible race, every possible country. I think 42 countries in just 1 year of admission. So, but yeah, the sharing of knowledge and the growing of the department really helped us. But then apart from that, I really focused on how can we give architects more agency? How can we change the role of the architect into something that is what it should be, I think. And for some reason, architects have, I think, helped themselves in the wrong way by focusing only on design. And I think design is our area where we have agency. But by adding research and innovation, you can have way more agency in leading big teams, in advancing what systems are developed to build our buildings. I have never been able to build a building without developing a new system because our systems are so outdated. They're ugly, over-dimensioned. They are not very smart.
Exactly, this is the case.
It's like...
Like we were talking also in the car, that education is not just about the design and also it should contain just the research project, which is now you're trying to bring in the and the programs that you're leading in them.
But it's also because, you know, I drive a Tesla, and my Tesla is working on, as you know, the sun. But also, it's amazingly designed. Technologically, it's super advanced. I can push a button and my windows come down. Now we think, why is she mentioning that? That's super normal. Well, have you found the building where you can push a button and the window goes down? Right? In my office, we have to hang with four people from an aluminum window that doesn't want to go down. It's unreal how far behind we are in the construction industry.
It's very slow, like even very conservative industry that doesn't accept technology as so much faster. And now in terms of design, we're a little bit ahead, but in terms of construction, we're so, so behind. Yeah. And what do you think about these new AI tools that are emerging? And again, I'm using the term new because it's actually quite new. It's not been even 4 or 5 months, maybe 4 months, not 5 months. Like, I don't know if you have heard of the Midjourney, DALL-E, that they are creating amazing design, and these designers are using these prompts to generate designs. What do you think about it?
Well, we work a lot on agent-driven designs at Penn also. I think that is very interesting. I'm more interested in that than the metaverse, let's put it that way.
Yes, indeed.
AI, I think, is really interesting. And it's like digital design. You know, in the beginning of digital design, everything was swoopy and uncontrolled and weird and whatever. But you have to go through this phase to learn the tools, to understand what it is. And I think it's the same with designs driven by AI, that we need to go through these morphing weird transitions, which are super interesting also. But like, I think we'll get to a point eventually where this will become also intelligent and smart and still driven by that. I think it's a very interesting technology. We use it a lot at Penn. And actually we have Acadia, our conference is coming up in October. And we have several workshops in that direction, both in robotics. As you know, we have one of the biggest robotics lab at this point in an architecture school.
This is after you came, this happened after you've been selected as...
Yeah. I did it like after 3 years. I was like, okay, this is time for... I remembered it was actually quite a bit of resistance because everyone was like, robotics and architecture, why
we should do the robots?
Because everything is...
Yeah, no, I'm just proposing the question by asking.
That was my answer to them, because everything is made by robots. And if we don't learn how to design for that, we're already behind. And, you know, one thing is, I do believe we have to prepare our students for 25 years ahead, not for next year. Right? Because, I mean, otherwise, what are we doing? It's an expensive study. So, but I think that's been really fun. So we have a gigantic robotics lab. I'm the director of it. We have several research labs in it. So in Acadia, we have a ton of robotics workshops, AI workshops. We are working on VR a little bit. VR, I find, is very behind. It seems to be that virtual reality environments have not developed. It's kind of stunning to me. They still look the same as they did, whatever, 15 years ago. And that's also a thing to start thinking of, you know, how do we develop these worlds and what is it? And shouldn't be more architects involved, because it seems that we're very stuck on a gaming environment that is always kind of out of control looking.
Right. And
you published recently a book called Stranger Objects. I don't have a copy here, unfortunately. That's why. But can you talk a little bit about the book and what are you actually talking about?
Mm-hmm.
What does it include?
Yeah, so this was interesting. We had three monographs, and we're talking to the editor of Aktar came for his studio visit in the office. And so I explained him the latest projects, and somewhere he started smiling, and I was like, what are you thinking? And he said, well, what I'm thinking is you don't need another monograph, you have three. I said, well, you know, I would like to do a book with you. And he's like, yeah, exactly, and me too, but I think you should do a book on the non-standard way you're working, which is super interesting, and I have actually hardly ever heard this before, because you're more like almost an industrial designer before you become the architect, and then you become the architect. And I actually love that idea, because it gave me a chance to talk to all the manufacturers I've worked with over the years. And by the way, the book is called Strange Objects, New Solids, and Massive Things.
Okay.
And new solids being goes back to 3D design, right? Where we never think of things that are without the other dimension. It's always like almost like the fourth dimension, let's say, as in mathematics, fourth dimension, the hypercube.
Massive objects.
And massive objects is really because we're interested in objects, but we like them to be sort of like opaque.
Mm-hmm.
Not because they have to be opaque, but just because I think there are too many glassy towers. So just how do you turn that around? What do you focus on is kind of the title. I have thought about just calling it Strange Objects, but we had a fantastic graphic designer called WSDIA, which means we should do it all. And they were really like, no, it has to have those three terms in there. So we did that. And as we are very, and the book is also non-standard because there is no text by someone else saying why this book is important.
No comments.
Because we didn't need that, we thought. But there is a text by the graphic designers, why the book is a strange object. And there is a great text by Manuel de Landa on the subject of, you know, non-standard and research and innovation and what that means for architecture. So there are several other texts. And of course, we all wrote in the office. We wrote a lot of text. But yeah, so it's non-standard, the book itself. It's made to look like a car manual of the 50s and 30s. The graphic designer was really inspired by those old, or tractor, I mean, it's more like tractor manuals. Because he was like, listen, you're talking about these components and how they go together and, you know, how do they go together? So the book is two pieces of cardboard and there is holes in it, so you can put it in a ring binder. Yeah. It's quite funny. Yeah, you will get one, I promise.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. And yeah, it's amazing conversation with you. And would you like to share anything with young designers and professionals out there?
Yeah, I think, you know, the one thing I realized over the years, keep putting your work out there, because by doing that, by putting your work out there, you'll get better clients that are interested in what you do, rather than just working in architecture to make money. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately we all hope, or the reason why we study so long as we do, is that we all hope that our work is a reflection of what we believe in and what we like to put out in the world, rather than the endless buildings that maybe are buildings, but not necessarily architecture. So I think just keep putting your work out there and clients will find you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. One last question. What do you think about our platform?
I admire parametric architecture in the way it grew, in the way you do actually put these young designers forward. It really helps them. I love looking at it. I find people to teach at Penn in it.
Yes.
And it's very inspirational. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
Great thing to have as a reference.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And I will look forward for your lecture at City Next Conference in 2 days. And thanks for this amazing conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Goodbye.
Bye.
Okay.